Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Canines Talking Sense. I'm your host, Cameron Ford, and as usual, out here in Las Vegas, in Sense City, I get to sit down on this episode and talk to somebody who I have admired as a trainer for a number of years. We've both just kind of crossed paths, just not at the same time, at the same location. But welcome to the show, Jens Frank. Jens, thank you for taking the time to come on here.
Thank you for having me. It's very exciting.
Definitely for me, because like I said, and I kind of mentioned to you through social media or whatever, I have absolutely admired you as a trainer for many of the things that you've done. But the thing that stood out to me the most was, as a trainer, you're very adaptable. You're not stuck doing just one way or one thing per se. And as I've gotten older, you know, as we age, we get wiser, as they say. But for me, what I've learned in the past, I'd say 4 or 5 years, was though I may like certain things of training or certain methods or a certain focus, what I've learned, especially these years working with dogs from the sport community, was I needed to be more diverse as a trainer. I needed to have the additional tools available to me, so that way I could work with as many dogs and handlers as possible. And I saw that in you as a trainer. You will adapt to the teams and the dogs in front of you. So that caught my eye, like I said, just because in this day and age where what is on social media or attention for certain things, there's great trainers out there. I just see the younger ones are very in a particular style, and nothing wrong with that. That's how I was too. I just now look at it differently, being again older and learning.
Are you saying that I am old?
I'm saying we're probably about the same age. So, and with, you know, age comes wisdom. So we've definitely, I would think, ties back to the part of where we failed many times. And because of those failures, we wanted to be better and adapt. And I share a story sometimes now, and I know you could relate to this, where, you know, the way I kind of equate it as a young trainer is like a young, you know, person, or in this case, a young man. They get their first set of tools and they have their toolbox. It's the very first one they've got. And it has a handful of tools, but nothing special. The older guy who, let's say, lives down the road, if you look in his shed, he has tools all over the place. And though he may not use a lot of them, he is the one that says, oh, you're going to work on this? Hold on. And he walks over to the corner, dusts off some stuff, and says, this is a tool for that. And that comes from, you know, the failures, the experience, the by having all those tools, he's so much more effective as a trainer, or in this case, as a, could be a, you know, some type of a mechanic or a carpenter or what have you. But yeah, it's just, you know, I like seeing, or I've learned, the more I collect and I learn, there's more tools now that I have in that toolbox. And I can now share that with whether it be handlers or newer trainers who just are kind of starting out. They just have that smaller kit and they're learning. But I look at somebody like you, who I've admired, because your tool shed has lots of tools in it.
That's a nice analogy. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, in this day and age, being able to work with, to me, a trainer who can work with as many different types of dogs and people as possible says a lot as a person. I mean, you could stick to something that you really like and you work with and you're good at it, but you adapt and you make changes for those teams that you're working with. You're not, I mean, I know what your background is, and you have, obviously, you've probably seen mine. We could have stayed working in the special forces type of dog. We could have stayed with police only all the time. But we've also branched out and worked with a number of different civilians and different sporting dogs. And those provide us a unique challenge that takes us out of a comfort zone. And I think that's very important for people to, because I know the struggles and I know you've seen it where people come to you and go, well, I wanted to train my dog like this, or I saw online a way of training, but it's not working for my dog. And I don't understand. And we can look at it and go, well, let's approach it from this angle and understand that this dog may not be crazy for a toy, but this dog is really good for food. And we can utilize many of the same techniques, but they're just, we're adapting to that dog.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. And yeah, my experience is that as long as we have at least one primary reinforcer, then there is a possibility to do some work. But different primary reinforcers has to be worked a bit different. And the more primary reinforcers we have available to work with in a dog, the easier the training will be and the longer we can get.
Yes. Yeah, that's critical to be, to understand that we have different tools available to us based on what the dog tells us works for them versus saying, I only like to use a tug or whatever. And, you know, having some understanding of that dog in front of me and it's what's reinforcing for it, what motivates it, and then utilizing that to my advantage.
Yes. Yes, I agree. There, yeah. There has been, well, if I am to generalize, I would say that many sports or pet dog people are a bit afraid to use tugging or toys and prefer using food as their primary reinforcer. And at least the older working dog people has been a bit the opposite. They would refuse using food as a primary reinforcer because it's seen as if you bribe the dog. And they would only use the toy or the tug at any time. So it is beneficial to adjust the reinforcer you use both to the dog and also to the arousal level that you need at this certain point of training.
I completely agree. That's a big one. And I want to go into that in a second. But before we get too deep in our good training conversations, tell us, you know, for those, like I said, the audience, we probably share a huge, significant audience there. We same people follow me, follow you kind of thing. But for those that who may not know who you are or just not as familiar or don't know that you're the one that has SWDI, tell us a little bit about you and how you got there and what you have today.
This is something you Americans, you're very good at these descriptions of yourselves. But I will make an attempt. I think I find that it often sounds good when you hear Americans doing this, but rather boring when I try. So I'm a biologist, and I started at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences as a PhD student in 1997. And then I worked half-time as doing my PhD in the wolf and lynx research projects and half-time as a field assistant in the same projects. And since then, since I did my PhD, I've been working as a scientist at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences, and I am still working there. And now I'm an associate professor. And since we're the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences, we are just doing very applied research. And what I have been working with has been using dogs, both in large carnivore management. That's where I started. We used dogs in order to catch lynx and follow wolves and bears. And in that line of work, I got appointed to be responsible for the large carnivore dog teams that the Swedish government uses to solve issues with mainly wolves and bears that create problems. So we used these dogs to document what the wolf or the bear has been doing, and in the cases the wolf or bear needs to be removed, as we say in Scandinavia, when we mean that we shoot it, then we use mm-hmm. these dog teams to track them down and do that as well. And I'm still working as one of the dog teams in that, and also as being responsible for the whole program together with my colleague Jessica Åberg. And the way the university works, we can mainly do research in the university, not very much training of government bodies or private persons for that matter. So then the university encourages us who work there to start institutes, whether it's the people, the biochemists developing drugs for veterinary use, or people like me working on other topics. They want us to create institutes that are loosely linked to the university, but mainly run as a company, which makes us able to do whatever we want. And that way the university gets a link to the reality or the society around us. So that way it benefits the research as well, because then we work together with the surrounding society and see what kind of science is needed. And we can also share the science or the applications that has been developed. So that's the Scandinavian Working Dog Institute that we were three people starting. It was me and Jessica and our third colleague, Tobias Gustafsson, who has been in this podcast as well earlier. Mm-hmm. So we started that, well, maybe now it's 15 years ago. And since a little bit more than 1 year, it's me and Jessica who runs the Scandinavian Working Dog Institute, where we train mainly government dog teams from police, military, customs, search and rescue, but also some sports or volunteers in search and rescue and other things. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's.
I was going to say, you did a great job.
Thank you.
Super interesting stuff that you've definitely done. And at the end there, you brought up something that I got to see most recently when I was in Austria and in Switzerland. And I've been over there a few times, and I lived in Germany for 5 years, years ago, long, long time ago. But there is definitely a unique thing that I've seen more recently that's different here in the States. So over here, as you know, the detection dog sports have really grown. And I'm seeing that growth now hit Europe. Switzerland is one of those areas where they're having quite a few of the sport dog competitions and things like that. But the thing that is very big over there is man trailing and tracking, even as a civilian activity or sport, for lack of a better term. But that isn't the same over here. You know, we do tracking, but most of the tracking or things of that nature have been put under the search and rescue aspect. There really hasn't been the same man trailing type competitive aspect that I saw in Europe that exists or doesn't exist over here. And I wondered if, let's just say, a tracking sport started growing here in the United States, I have a feeling it would become quite popular like I see it over in Europe. So like you were mentioning there at the end of what you're describing, tracking is definitely something that's very popular in Europe. and done quite a bit in civilian aspects. And I guess that's where you've done quite a bit with it too.
Yes. So in Sweden, that's an extremely popular form of competition and has been for many decades before I was born. So, and it's still the same. It's very popular. So for every competition, there are more people who want to participate than there are places. So they have a lottery which ones get in. So it's extremely extremely popular and a very big community that does tracking. But then it's mainly tracking in the forest since, well, we have a lot of forests here.
Yes, you definitely do. And that's what's so unique too. You know, obviously Europe land-wise is smaller than the United States, but the United States and Europe both have diverse types of environments, you know, like obviously where you're at comparative to Italy and so forth. And it presents tracking man trailing, whatever anybody wants to call it, very unique environments to do this type of work in. Just like over here, you could be in swamps and down in southeast of the United States, or you could be up in the, you know, where I'm at, desert areas where there's not very much types of ground to work with other than rocks and dirt. And then you go up to Northern California, and that's more like your guys' environment where there's lots of woods and green and everything. So it's just interesting to me how it didn't take off over here as a sport like it is for you guys. And like you said, it's been around for a long time. And a lot of civilians, this is what they do with all types of dogs.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, that's strange. I would have guessed that it would catch on quite big if you launched it today, because there seems to be a big interest in it.
Oh, yes. There is absolutely a big interest in tracking, you know, which is, you know, like we both know Jeff Shetler, he travels all over the world too, you know, teaching classes. And I at first was surprised. I'm like, wow, he's really popular in Europe. And now I know why, because of the huge civilian aspect that does it. And he's popular here in the United States, but it's just in different circles. It's mostly the law enforcement, some of the military, a few of the search and rescue groups, and I don't know it intimately enough to expand, but just seeing what I can see from social media that he shares over here, it's a lot more official related, but then he goes to Europe and it's really both. There's a huge civilian component that he's working with. So I had to ask the question when I was with Florian and another lady who I was with in Switzerland, and they definitely enlightened me of really how popular it was. And I thought to myself, oh man, if someone, I have zero time for that, but if someone were to say, you know what, let's create a tracking man trailing sport here in the United States, holy cow, it would be out of control fast. So I'm sure at some point when people listen to this episode, someone's going to go, ding, 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 I have an idea.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
We have as a training sometimes, done something that I would think would be a really good TV tracking sport. So if you imagine a soccer field, or you could use the American football field. Mm-hmm. So at the short end, you have 10 people starting, and then they all meet in the center point and disperse in different directions again, but they must end up at the other short end. So then at the start, they left a small badge with a number, and at the end, they leave another badge with the same number. And then we have 10 tracking dog teams who start at the same time, and the one who reaches their badge the first wins the game. Wow. And then it's full contact. So you can either try to go quick to get ahead of the others, or you can just try to ruin for the others by making a havoc yourself or your dog. And it's really challenging, and it's extremely fun. And I take one of our drones and put it over the center and film the whole thing. And then you can look and analyze afterwards. But if there were heats like that, because each heat is it's below 1 minute long, I think it would be extremely fun to watch.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, not only the dynamic, everything you mentioned, but then being in that environment, you have to have a really solid dog to handle 9 other dogs and people working in close proximity to you. Yes. I think there would be a lot of teams that want to do that. And then there would be a lot of teams whose dogs would probably say, no, I can't do that based on my sensitivity or reactivity to other dogs that close. But like you said, maybe that's part of the goal, is to, you know, like you said, wreak havoc on some of your competitors with a very distracting dog. It'd be like one of those bloodhounds that while they're searching is baying the whole time. Ooh, you know, and all the other dogs are like, what is wrong with that dog?
Yes.
Man, that is quite the idea. I mean, that is so challenging on so many levels. And it's funny that you brought that up, because, you know, I had been sharing the past probably a year or so, you know, myself, Michael, and my trainer, Natalie, we are definitely going to be doing, we don't want to call it a sport per se. We just want to call it games. We're just gonna call it detection dog games. So it won't be like any kind of organized association or anything like that. It's just going to be randomly in different locations. Whenever somebody hosts it, it'll be detection dog game challenge, whatever you wanted to, you know, kind of coin it. Mm-hmm. But each event is different, and it's set up by the imagination of the judge, what the challenges are. Any number of different types of detection dogs could compete, because then they all compete on the same kind of environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other odors are just nothing more than distracting odors for your dog, and vice versa. And then, like I said, just like you said, being super creative with really interesting ways to have that particular event. So there was like no way to necessarily prep like the current sports that exist. You know, you have interiors, you know, you have exteriors, you know, you have certain things. But mm-hmm. in this sport, you would never know until the day of what it is that you're facing, whether it's like on or off leash, all kinds of stuff.
A bit like PSA for detection dogs.
Yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like this, you know,
and that sounds really fun.
Michael had a great idea of creating like a decathlon version of this. So you have to do 10 events to get that aspect. And of course, score X amount, whatever the points would be to mm-hmm. accomplish this. But that makes it fun too, because now it's 10 different challenges over a course of however long it takes you to get that. We had really unique ideas too. So to not have it just only be detection, but could be another aspect for a dog, like combining, there's some search work, but then jump into a dock diving pool and retrieve a specific item out and bring it to you. And how challenging, we both know that is, when you put, let's say, 10 items in floating in water and the dog is to retrieve only the specific one, like I was thinking of, fixing the handler to a certain position so they can't leave a certain spot, but being able to direct and send the dog to a very specific area and then search that area and tell you yes or no, is odor there? And if it is, obviously do its trained response. But if it's nothing, the handler has to know this and get the dog back to them. And it could be a maze. You know, you could have a maze and you're at one point and you have to use some type of directional, whether it be maybe hand signals, but maybe the position you're in, the dog can't see you. So then now what do you do? You know, so a lot of different, I know as soon as people are watching and listening to this, they're going to be like, when are you guys going to make this happen? we're going to become victims of our own hype here. Of these, you'll be like, Jens is coming over to Michael's and Cameron's, and then we're going to have this tracking thing and detection dog games. And, yes. Oh my God. It'll be out of control really fast.
But it sounds like a great idea. I would think it would be fun to participate. And I think a lot of other people would as well.
That's the whole reason why I wanted to do it. I wanted to do it because I want to do something like that. Yes. And And I wanted to focus on important things like the dog's ability to tell the handler where they found it. I don't care how it, whatever its response is, but can it maintain that? Can the handler read that? Can it be done under various types of distractions or environmental things to deal with? And less about how fast, because right now current things are very speed related. And we both know when you increase speed or you're graded on how fast you find things, there's a degradation of other things like the alert or handlers maybe not reading completely what their dog was telling them because they're trying to be very fast at calling out the alert. And over time, you know, it takes not a very long period of time, but then now you have these other things you're working on because the trial environment and what you did there is not what you do in training, or you start your training to look like that trial environment. And now you really have issues with alert, distractions, handlers reading their dogs and so forth. So I wanted to get away from speed as a focus and get back into the things that we both know from, you know, dealing with dogs operationally. You have to be able to read your dog and have a good indication under a number of different unique circumstances, and they're never the same. So I think of that as a challenge, and how the odor is presented in the area, if it's presented, you know, high, how deep, how many layers of masking could we come up with, and could the dog still find it? And these are the things that we in the world of working in the professional side of things dealt with as a reality, not a competitive aspect, but just it was our reality. Our reality was people are trying to get things past a dog and past a handler. They're going to conceal it in many, it's only limited by an imagination. But can a good, sound dog team solve that problem and tell me if something is there or not? And that's the fun part. That's the part, as I became a bomb dog handler, I was like, how do I beat the bomber? How do I survive, number one? And then number two, could I read my dog well enough, even if I couldn't get directly close to it? You know, and then, you know, I got into things within the special forces community. There, we didn't necessarily want the dog get to source. We just wanted to know, is something there? And we're going to recall the dog. We didn't need the dog to go all the way up to source because there's significant risk at that. So, but that was a challenge in itself. You know, that was difficult to teach new handlers how to read this. And then it worked successfully operational because of conditions being uncontrollable in a operational environment. No matter how we try in training to replicate that, training still has a level of training to it. So
yes,
I think
with the detection sport that you will now be forced to start, it would be good to have as an aim that operational dog handlers should be able to participate as well, because they really need challenges after they have reached their certification, which is very early in both the dogs and handlers' career. It's very good if we can help them to develop and not try to do maintenance training just to stay floating above the certification, because that is usually problematic. The training becomes boring. But if you could supply the increased level of challenge in a sport like this, I think it would be really, apart from being really fun, it would also be very helpful to ordinary operational dog handlers in the police and the military.
Yes, I very much agree. There's a lot of aspects like you bring up that you could do in that environment to prepare, you know, teams even better because of conditions like that, that you could do. And the biggest thing is it's the experience. We both know, you know, it takes time. And the more deployments you have, the more skilled you actually become. And you see what actually worked well in training, maybe also what didn't work well in training. and the test was the actual deployment. And then you're like, okay, so these things seem to work really well that came from my training side of things. Or, man, this is what I'm doing in training, and I can see it having a problem on the operational side. So another level of doing that would be that competition aspect that gives you that experience that, because depending on where you work and you're an operational handler, whether it be all the way from search and rescue to law enforcement, military, if your environment is not very busy, it just is going to take you a lot longer to reach that experience or to go through those deployments where you get those lessons. So the only other way would be some type of competitive aspect where you don't know the answer, similar to your deployment. You face very unique things that you don't see in training, and you are allowed to get your lessons learned and become better.
Yes. Many handlers are very motivated, and most can find time here and there to do training. But what often is the limitation is the lack of preparation or planning, and sometimes even fantasy to challenge yourselves, because you only know what you know. So then have someone else coming up with all these more or less crazy scenarios that you will probably never encounter will give you an opportunity to develop the skills and make you more ready to encounter what you will actually face.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the flow channel illustration? It's a guy, I cannot even try to pronounce his last name. It starts with C-S-I-E, something like Csikszentmihalyi. Okay. He developed the flow channel illustration, and he did it for training of humans. But I think it translates really well also to training dogs. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine a graph where on the x-axis you have skills and on the y-axis you have challenge.
Okay.
He suggests that the flow channel would then be 45 degrees facing upwards between these two axes. Mm-hmm. And if you go further to the right, so that is, let's say if you train the dog to manage the certification and keep on training there just to maintain the dog's ability, then the dog's skills will increase. But because the challenge is not increasing, the dog ends up in boredom. And then we lose control over what we are reinforcing, because the dog gets bored out of doing the same exercise the 50th or 100th time. And the same, if you increase the level of challenge too quick before the dog has acquired the level of skills, it will get anxious and have no idea what it's supposed to do in order to get what it wants. And then he suggests that we need to stay in the flow channel. And if we apply this to working dog teams, that means, or that illustrates why it's impossible to train the dog to the certification level and then just do maintenance training. Mm-hmm. You need to challenge the dog further throughout the dog's whole life to be able to stay well above the certification level. If you just try to stay at certification level, the dog's performance will go down because it gets bored, starts thinking about squirrels or birds or other things while you're doing your detection or obedience, and then you reward other things than you intended to.
Oh, for sure. And like I said, it piggybacks something I was sharing with the group in Austria, which was habitual learning and them staying in one thing for so long, whatever the thing was. And in this case, a majority of them, it was the brick walls. So all I did was put odor just 1 foot off of the brick wall. Just there's a pole that was like off the side of the brick wall, and I put the odor there. It took so long. Most dogs didn't even find it. It took so long for the dogs, or for at least two dogs, to be mentally flexible enough to try something different than the wall, even though the odor was right there. The odor, it wasn't like it was difficult, but I had been following, and Michael had shared an article with me about, though we see value in certain tools and training, if we become too reliant on it, the dog becomes less flexible in its ability to problem solve, especially in the presence of whatever the habituation was. So in this case, a common brick wall, which can be found in a lot of places. And if the team has done so much of that and not diversified either early enough or frequent enough, the dog lacked the skill to try something different. And like I tell everybody, whether that's a wall or a wheel or whatever it is, what we had to start doing, and the lessons I've learned, was I needed to change the context more frequently or sooner than I expected, because though I was working on something or I felt comfortable and I was seeing good success in the dog, I was also making them more resilient to change because I kept doing the thing, whatever that was, or in some cases, how or the type of odor I'm using. So it's not just to a device, it's also to the training material, whatever your training odor is. If you're only using your kit, your dog says, okay, I know this one really well. And if there's something that's slightly different, they're like, well, you know, I don't know. And then that's where the handler confidence changes, because their dog's not doing what they typically have seen in training, because that's what they knew. So yeah, it's the habituation and the inflexibility part is something that we definitely need to start talking more of, because I think just being human, we get into ruts, or we do something that we like, or we do something that we seem as fun for our dogs because it's very successful, and then we do it too much, you know, or we see our friend or a trainer who's really good at something and we want to do that too, and then lo and behold, because our dog is different, we created a problem that we didn't even know we did.
Yes. Yeah, especially the brick wall is seducing, especially if you live in Sweden. So right now it's summer and it's quite nice. But in the fall, when it's dark and cold, it's so easy to just go out and do a 10-minute session on the brick wall, because you can have it inside, you can have a light. Oh. And then if you do that for 10 minutes almost every day, you are probably creating more problems than you are solving.
Very much agree.
It's so easy to get stuck in these habits.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And that's, and I've been guilty of it myself. I can't tell you how many times, and because when you're a trainer, you kind of get into that mode of training all the time, or you're preparing dogs from the beginning. So you tend to have a majority of your time focused in a certain stage of training, which is mostly the beginning stages. And you kind of need, which for me, it's what I needed. I needed somebody to say, hey, look, you know, you need to make some changes sooner. And for me, it was through cognition. And the more I learned about the cognitive ability of dogs, and then doing the tests myself and knowing that I really have a short window of time if I have a dog who's very memory oriented to solve problems. Because if I keep feeding the memory as this is the thing that we're doing, as soon as there's a change, they fall apart faster, or they're really rigid to whatever the thing was that they were using their memory for to solve the problem. I'm now, you know, again, back in the day as a trainer, I would scratch my head and go, I wonder why I'm struggling with this. And it turns out it's because I took a dog who was strong in memory, and I kept doing the same thing over and over again because I was working on, in my case, I'm doing fundamentals, I'm doing foundational work, not knowing that that dog needed to see change way sooner, way more often, so they could grow as a detection dog and not be held back because for whatever the reason was at that time, I would say I'm working on this and I'm going to keep doing it for this many reps. And, you know, I had learned that those were some valuable lessons. And I see that now, you know, with the growth of social media and so many people, you know, getting into detection, they see the fun things that they are attracted to online, and then they want to replicate that. And they again, I see the dog who's done it too many times. And like I said, just simply putting the odor slightly off of the location, I didn't change much. I just moved it a little bit. And to me, this is where, you know, again, we both agree, odor has to be the most important thing. If everything else is almost worthless, if the dog doesn't understand what's looking for, I can have amazing searching, I can have amazing play, but if my dog doesn't know what it's looking for or is competent in the odor, none of the other stuff truly mattered at the end of the day. It looks cool, it's very pretty, but again, as I've learned, I really want to be good at showing this dog various ways to see the odor. And if I've tapped into, like you said earlier, the primary reinforcers, and I communicate clearly, I want you to find the odor, and you do a lot of the same things, the delayed conditioning, the odors first, followed by the reinforcer, and you get a really good, strong connection psychologically that way. It then motivates the dog to go look for the odor. They understand the chain is find the odor, it gets me my reinforcer, whatever it is, and I love doing that. And which brings me to the question I have from you. What do you, when you're working with detection dogs, and you can modify this however you want, because we both know it's going to change a little bit based on the dog team in front of me, but what are the important things to you that you are looking for, that you are trying to accomplish in your training when you're working with a detection dog team, both the handler and the dog?
So I think it will be a boring answer, because I think the most important thing is discipline.
Okay.
From the handler's part. So I need them to have a clear view of the goal. So what is it they're supposed to achieve in the end? And then when we break that down into sub-goals, that helps the dog handler, but it doesn't do his or her job. They still need to be disciplined enough to not reinforce the dog when they think the dog deserves it, but reinforce the dog when it meets the criteria for the behavior that they are looking for, whatever it is. And I find that that is an easy thing to say, but a difficult thing to do, not to reinforce behaviors that you actually don't want and punish by negative punishment behaviors that you actually want to see more of. So I would say that's the number one thing that I can help with as a trainer, to help them be more consistent and disciplined and loyal to the end goal.
Yes, I really, yeah, it makes total sense. I liked, you said it differently than what I've said and what I've heard others say, but the version I typically share is I make them, like you said, we call it end state. What is your goal? Okay, I want my dog to, in this particular training session, find the odor that, and it may be deeper than normal. So the dog who's had a strong history of finding it very close to the surface is probably, or may show me some confusion. So how, before I even start, what am I going to allow the dog to do to communicate this? How do I reinforce that effort that the dog is going to do to show it to me, because they can't get to it like they normally do? And then once I get that, what do I do next? Do I redeploy the same, do a refind? Or do I go to the next one, which I've already set, that might be a little bit easier, so that way I can reward the typical required response? And even still, there's that answer depends on what my goal is. So I make them write that down first. What is the goal, like you said?
Yes.
What will I accept based on the conditions? And then what do I do to communicate that that was desired? And the biggest thing I see traveling is where the criteria, like you said, then followed by mechanics and timing is where things really fall apart. So the criteria isn't clear, then the mechanics aren't really clear, and then the timing is off. And sometimes just having one of those things off is detrimental and confusing to the dog, let alone if you have three of those things off. So I think, like you said, it's really important to document what you're doing. And then afterwards, what I'll do is I film a lot of it now. I used to never do that. Now I film everything. And then I have them write down what the dog did before they get to watch the video. And then we watch the video and see, does it match what they said? And if there's some type of discrepancy, why? You know, maybe it's the human memory. Maybe it was just, you know, we did a couple of things and I remembered one thing. But it's important, you know, to do that versus the easy thing of just throwing out some training hides, running around, finding them, putting my dog up, and not really breaking down the things that I did as a handler. And where I need to improve either on the criteria, the mechanics, the timing, because all of those things, you know, are the most critical part in the success. Because if we fail the dog on that part of it, their growth is stunted because of my inability.
It's a really good idea to have them write down what the dog did before watching the video. I will steal that idea. It's a really good idea. I have never tried it.
It's really unique because, so there's a couple things that happen. One is just the normal memory of what somebody did. Now, what you create, if you have them long enough, as soon as they're done working their dog, they'll go right to their notes and start writing down right away, versus waiting until an hour later or however long later, because the more time that goes by, or if you're watching other dogs, your brain will mesh the things that you saw in other dogs. And now you forgot. And those that are on the legal side of dogs, this is really important, because what you write down in your report or in your records needs to truly match. And in this day and age where everything is filmed, there's probably going to be some type of video of what occurred. And does it match reasonably to what you wrote down versus being so different? And I think there's just value in making people write something down versus hopping on their phone, typing it, or talking it to their phone or something like this. The process of pen to paper makes a big difference. I know you go through, don't you go through like various modules or exercises for your students? And do you go there? Like, give us an example of what you do with your students for their like modules and things like that.
So I like to first set a specific and measurable end goal. So, and that should depart from the unit's operational work, not the certification, because the certification is often a more results-oriented goal where someone is judging. So I want this to be a specific and measurable goal related to the work that they are actually doing. So then it can be things, if we're talking, well, for the indication, for example, it should be what kind of distance they want the dog to have, minimum or maximum, since that will vary depending on if you're searching for semen or saliva, or if you're searching for explosives or drugs. And I want them to state for how long a duration they need the dog to be in the indication, and how many times out of 10 they want the dog to be able to do this. And I find that that is very useful that they discuss, because when you write these goals down, it's so easy to say, yeah, the dog needs to be indicating for 30 seconds and it has to sit and point with the nose. But when you discuss it and relate to the working tasks, it generally is enough with 3 or 5 seconds of duration of the indication. And it's not that important that the dog is pointing exactly as the source, because in operational use, there will rarely be this very specific location. It will be a door or a car or even a whole building they don't want the dog to indicate. So just having to specify measurable goals makes you, just the process makes you set more realistic and operational friendly goals rather than the, so it's based on the need, not the nice. And then we have the end goals, and then we can break it down in sub goals, and then each module will form a sub goal. So, and then it's not always a straight line. So for the indication, for example, you may start working on the position, just the mechanics of movement, if you want the dog sitting or standing or lying down. So then we take it out of a detection context. So that could be one example of a module. And then in the latter end of the spectrum, when the dog has learned the indication and we start to do longer detection, one module could be vehicle search, interior and exterior. Another module is deep hides, where the target is hidden 1 meter behind the door or inside a bag in a box inside a cupboard or something like that. So we're working on the more diffuse scent picture. So, and this follows your question before, what we or I can help the dog teams with as a trainer. And that is, for example, training the variable reinforcement schedule, which can be a bit hard on the handler's heart sometimes, not rewarding the dog, although it's doing the behavior in an okay matter. I think that is something that most dog handlers need someone pushing them into. Otherwise, they will just postpone and postpone and postpone until they don't have the desirable effect from it. And also to, as you said before, start placing the targets more difficult. So if, at least this is my experience, if I have the handlers hiding targets for themselves or each other, they place the targets in a way that will make it most likely that the dog finds close to 100% of the targets. Well, I aim at hiding the targets in a way that I believe that at best the dog team will find 50%. I think that's a good proportion, because then I know that it's on the edge of their capacity. So we may then stay in this flow channel and challenge them. And as they get better, we will hide it more difficult so that they stay finding maximum 50% of the targets. Because if we hide in a way that aims for the dog handlers to find close to 100%, then we adjust the hiding to the dog's capacity. And that's a good way of staying at the same skill level and not giving them a chance to develop.
I absolutely love that. I think that is so important, because the mentality so frequently is my dog must find whatever's out, but that's not reality. We can never measure how much we miss because we missed it. But if we make training so easy, just like you said, we're not growing at all. We're setting ourselves up and our dogs up for failure when we go out into those real conditions or those competition conditions. What I was going to ask earlier is, so as you have something higher or deeper, when you're first doing this, do you reinforce the dog's effort as they're solving this versus waiting for the perfect final response? Because obviously we both know in many cases, the dog's not going to do the trained final response because this is a different dynamic than they're used to, but we don't want to ignore the effort. So how do you go about communicating, you're right, keep going?
So I prefer, if it's possible, I prefer not to do any, use any keep going signal in that context. Mm-hmm. But as also when the tasks are easier, I mean, you know, as a dog trainer, what we're doing is that we're mainly balancing the dog's expectations. So if I every time reinforce the dog when it has indicated and been sitting for 10 seconds, then the dog is every time reinforced for sitting down. And that's not the important part of the behavior. The important part of the behavior is locating the target. And what I want the dog handler to do is to vary when they reinforce. So sometimes they reinforce the dog after it has been sitting for 5 or 10 seconds. But most of the times I want them to reinforce when the dog is reacting and starts to think about doing the final response, because then the dog is not able to know exactly when the reinforcement will come. It just knows that this is the important, well, spot or location right here. And I think that prevents a lot of issues that you can otherwise have with false alerts, especially with the dogs that are not very highly motivated. So the typical pet dogs, if you just reinforce them after they have been sitting and indicating for 5 or 10 seconds, then you will get a lot of that behavior when they just try to sit down, because that is the, in their mind, that's the most salient behavior that they have been reinforced for, not reacting to the odor.
Yes. And it was probably my bad translation of what I was trying to explain. And I used the word keep going. I was meaning that I wanted the dog to keep doing that thing going to the odor. So just exactly like you said, when the dog is working the odor and showing me that it's trying to get there, but there's just some difficulties, I reinforce that. And then maybe a different search or this search again, I raise the criteria to be more committed to it, because now it understands, oh, okay, I was on the right track. I didn't have to go into, like you said, a full sit for 10 seconds before I get reinforced. But handlers, what I see very frequently is, because they know their dog alerts to odor in a very simple context, then all of a sudden when the context has more difficulty to it and the dog is struggling, then they, in their mind, they think they have to, the only way they should reward is if the dog goes into the sit. But they're missing out the important part, what you just said, which is the odor is important. I don't want the dog to lose motivation for the odor because it thinks that the sitting is required. And just like you said, then the byproduct of that thinking is going to bring up more false alerts, because the dog's like, oh, it's the sitting that matters. Like you said, the most salient thing, not the odor. And of course, which is why I want odor to always pay and not just the behavior. Now, of course, like we both said, there are going to be conditions where I want these things to happen. Mm-hmm. There are many conditions in which I really want to reinforce the dog's forward motion towards odor despite the condition. And the real world is full of these conditions that we can't replicate, or we just don't see or don't do enough of in training. and again, we're sometimes too, I don't want to use the word sterile, but we're too predictable in the training of, oh, it must be this if you find odor. And if we show the dogs these challenges in training, it becomes much easier as a handler when it's operational or trial or testing to see what that looks like. Oh, my dog's definitely in odor right now. It's not going into response, but I know that's odor because it's doing these predictable things despite it not being able to get into its typical trained final response, whatever it is. Which does bring me to another question that's always coming up, and I'm sure you get it quite a bit. I know what I think, but I'm just curious to know what your opinion is. So people these days like definitive answers. Should I have my dog sit or should I have my dog do a nose freeze? What is acceptable? I'm just curious, what do you typically say when people bring this question up to you, despite what your preference is, but just I'm curious to know both. Like, how do you answer that question when people ask you, well, should I have a sit or should I do a nose freeze? I've heard this or that about each one of those.
So I would say it depends what kind of work it is you're doing. So in the end, I think if the dog is working at a distance, so if you use directionals or laser to send the dog at a long distance to do detection, I prefer the sit indication because it's easier to see at the long distance. And also many times if you search for explosives or other material where you want the dog to have a certain distance, it's most of the time easier to get that distance if the dog goes into a sit. But I would say most dog teams, they want the dog to use sit, down or stand as long as it points with the nose. But I still recommend that they start with one of them in the training, because it's easier to teach the dog one set of criteria, for example, for the sit, and then you allow the dog to be a little bit more fussy about these criteria and remain standing or lie down when it's more convenient than going the other way. So in my experience, it's quicker to reach an end where the dog takes any position as long as it's pointing, if we start with one of the positions, teaching the dog to do that reliably.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's something, the term I've used, and this was more specifically in the law enforcement community because of some of the legal things they had to deal with. The term I just used was a focused response to odor. It could be standing, could be sitting, could be lying down. Many times it depended on where the odor was in proximity to the dog. However, just like you said, there's also the considerations as a trainer. Well, what type of detection is this dog doing? And exactly like you said, coming from the special forces community, there were certain requirements that we had or that we needed depending on the environment, like you said, the distance in which the dog is working from the handler, and in some cases, the type of dog that we had. We even made, you know, let's just say, like you said, the typical response was going to be a sit response, but we've also had dogs that it was much better to have them freeze because that was also natural for them to do, and they were, it was just more clear to them. So it did take some extra skills of the handler to be patient, to allow the dog sometimes when it's investigating something, it looks very still, but it's just not completely still. I think you even saw a video today. I have my Labrador. He's a firearms dog. He's a lockup, but his lockup is completely unmistakable. Yes. But when he's investigating something, he's not nearly as rigid. He's still, but he's sniffing whatever thing that's interesting to him. Which is funny because when I've used him to teach students, they would read that at first as, oh, he must be alerting, and they would be way too fast to reinforce him. So he learned really quickly when there's somebody new behind him, he'll go, oh, maybe they will pay me if I just stay still for a second. But it creates great conversation for discussing this, because I want them to read, you know, depends on what kind of dog they'll do later on. But I want them to see, okay, this is actually an alert. This is just the dog sniffing. But it brings up that really good conversation, like you just mentioned, what is clear for the handler to read, especially depending on the job and your distance from the dog. There's a few other things that have to be considered too, because certain positions elicit other anticipatory behaviors like licking or nudging maybe a little bit in their delay of waiting for the reinforcer, because maybe the handler for whatever reason decided, well, I'm going to wait this time. So now the frustration kicks in. And this is where like Dr. Nathan Hall was really good about giving that analogy of a vending machine versus a slot machine. And if your vending machine doesn't give you the food right away when you put your money in there, what do you do? Well, you have an emotional response. And if we've become so predictable like a vending machine to our dogs that typically they receive their reinforcement pretty quickly after they put their money in, they respond. When all of a sudden you delay, let's say 10 seconds, 20 seconds, they're going to think the machine could be broken. And then you might see in that dog, especially a dog with high motivation, an emotional response. And that could be disturbing the training source. It could be doing some undesired behaviors. And then, of course, we both know Murphy's Law kicks in right when the dog scratches or bites or is right when the handler reinforces. And then now, what did we just do? So it's a really good you have to consider what are you going to do, you know, as a handler. What are you going to do with your job? And then that way you'll know what you want to train as a final response. And I like that answer too. Like you said, all of them are useful. You just have to know what is your criteria and what are you going to reinforce as you do this.
Yeah, I find that the indication is the simple part of the detection work. It's getting the rest to work reliably that is the hardest and takes the longest time.
Yeah, for sure. It brings up another point that I have seen, obviously, because I travel a lot, but there's, again, a distinct difference between United States mindset and detection versus the European. And that is rewarding and reinforcing the dog for searching. It's much more common over in Europe while the dog is searching, and let's say it's searching for however many minutes, or there was a unique challenge to the search. Many handlers bring the dog back to them, give the dog a reward, reward the dog to kind of take the edge off a little bit, reward the search itself. But as soon as you cross the Atlantic Ocean, you come to the United States, the mentality is, why would I ever reward my dog for doing anything but finding the odor? And if I rewarded my dog simply for searching, I'm going to get a dog who's going to false on me all the time because it just wants its reward. We both definitely know why we do these things. I'm just curious, how do you share that with the students and show them the importance of rewarding searching while the dog's searching?
That's once again... It depends, answer, because maybe it's more in the beginning of the detection dog's career that I would consider rewarding the dog just for searching in a messy or difficult context. But the further I train the dog, the more focused I will be on the dog's technique, so that it has a high sniffing frequency and preferably a closed mouth. And the only way that I can reinforce this is by making the targets more and more difficult to find, so that the dog has to use a proper technique in order to find the target and then get the reward. I have not found it possible to communicate how or which technique to use by clicking or rewarding the dog when it is searching, because searching is, it's a chain of behaviors, and I don't really have control over which part of the chain I am reinforcing when I do the clicking. So I would do it where I see that I need to increase the intensity or motivation in the dog to be able to continue. But the further I get in the training, the less I typically do that, and the more I try to make the targets hidden in a way that is challenging enough for the dog only to find them for with using the technique that I want to reinforce, because then the dog is, well, it's punished if it searches with open mouth and not really taking deep sniffs. Then it will not find anything, and then it gets no reinforcement. So I try to build on that.
That brings me to another good question that comes up often. For you, how important is it to introduce control negative or a blank search? And how often or how frequent might you do this? And again, I know the answer depends on the dog and the type of work that they do, but as a general or a average rule, how important is it and how often do you introduce that or bring that into the search?
I think it's critical, mainly for the handler. So I will introduce it after, let's say, after 3 weeks, typically. I have the indication working in different contexts, and then I will do blank searches. And that is because then both the dog and the handler needs to get used to how to use a protocol when searching just a simple lineup of consoles or boxes. So let's say they have as a protocol to search the lineup of 6 boxes once. So the dog has one chance on each box. If it doesn't make the find, well, then the handler will call the dog off or just continue walking. Because if you cannot, as a handler, make this work on a lineup of 6 boxes with one hole in each, so it's basically 6 positions the dog is searching, then it will be impossible to do it on vehicles or indoor or outdoor areas where there are thousands of possible locations, and you cannot let the dog think it has an infinite amount of time. So you need to develop a protocol that you follow. And when you find something, everything is easy. But for the most searches, you don't find anything. And at a certain point, you need to decide that, okay, I've been searching this following my protocol. We have not found anything. And then I know from my training and testing that means that 9 times out of 10, there is nothing here to find. So it's blank. So I think the earlier we introduce them, the better, mainly for the handler. For the dog, I'm not sure it makes a difference.
Yeah, I basically, I do the same thing. I introduce it early on. Like you said, the handler for sure has to see this, because as an evaluator, when I'm certifying dog teams from different programs, just like you said, finding odor is the easy part. And I know most of them are good at this. It's the not finding it and calling there's nothing here is much harder for a handler to do. But those that can, it shows me the confidence they have with them and their dogs. Because, again, when teams are newer and there's nothing there, they will still come over to you and say, I didn't find anything, but there's my dog showed interest over here or over there, whatever it is that they can try to do. So they have an escape in case there was something there, versus the one who has a better understanding of their dog. They walk over to you and they, there's nothing here. And I really like that as an evaluator, when I can see a team have that level of confidence to call that. And like you said, we have to build that in training. We have to explore what that looks like, get the handler good at reading that. Starting off, I start it in the exact same position you do. I do it in the odor recognition testing phases, where we do lineups, and then there's a possibility of zero, and they get their first chance to see what zero looks like and get better at that. So it's really cool that we see the same things when it comes to that. It's such a critical aspect to, again, that's one of the areas we have to push to be uncomfortable, is to have the possibility of zero. And like you said, and again, bringing up Dr. Nathan Hall, I was part of this when we were doing the research on it. And it matched what you said earlier about 50% of the time finding something. So there was a group of dogs, you might have already read the research because it just came out recently, where there was the dogs that were at the 90% find ratio versus the dogs that were trained to a 20% find ratio. But on testing day, it was a 10% find ratio. Of course, the dogs who constantly found things in training did very poorly when there was a 10% find ratio. The dogs who were at trained to 20% did much better, scored really well at the 10% find ratio, because they were already used to the probability that finding odor was lower. And that what was really cool, that was unique, that I got to watch as a trainer, when we did bring it down, as we were teaching the dogs that finding something was not always so predictable. But the cool thing was, when odor was introduced, the dog's reaction was even stronger when it appeared, as opposed to the dogs who found it regularly. So it actually goes against what most think should happen in training, which is you should have frequently find things. Truly, what we saw was when you brought the odor in randomly at a lower percentage, the dog's reaction and response was even stronger than it was with frequent finds. What's your thoughts on that?
Yes, because I think then you're tapping into the effects of the variable reinforcement schedule.
Absolutely. And, absolutely.
That is the effect that we expect to see from that. So I think it makes perfect sense.
Yep. And it like anything else, and again, you're a big detection dog person. You've probably heard me say this before, but maybe not. I bring up that we're truly, to me, in a renaissance period for detection dogs. There's far more science available to us than there ever has been the previous 20 years. We are looking at things much differently. There needs to be changes from the ways that we've done things to a more probably efficient and clearer thing. And we're getting there. We're doing these things. But there's definitely, like anything, when there's change, there's going to be the way we've always done it, and then what we need to start doing. And people, depending on where they're at in their career, may struggle with the change or embrace the change. So it kind of depends. But I definitely see that we are in a very special time when it comes to detection, not only for those things, but also what I look at the future of is the technology mixing with dogs moving forward. What do you think, or what do you see on that as well?
Yeah, I have. I am involved in some projects where different authorities, military or law enforcement, work on combining very advanced technology and using dogs as vectors for this. And I think they have a very big capacity in filling that role, a bit like, yeah, they can be a substitute to drones or an add-on to drones in many contexts. And from what I see, that is developing really fast, and we're not even close to having seen the peak of that. So I think they will go from being mainly a detector device. I think they will fill just as large a role as vectors, you may call it, carrying devices to different locations and also doing some tasks there where of detection will be one of them.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I got to see some really cool things that were in development some years ago, knowing what was coming, knowing the amount of money that the government was putting into the research of technology and dogs together. Even one of, I'm sure, one of our probably mutual colleagues, Jorg, he does the artificial intelligence aspects with dogs and how he uses AI to teach the dog, and he's not even in the room, along with, again, what Dr. Nathan Hall created with his olfactometer boxes that automate and pick randomly which box has odor or not odor or mixing odors. And he literally can just stand there in the room, and he's pretty much nothing more than this, the device that gives the reward based on the dog's response to the boxes in the computer system. And yes, it's super humbling when you watch a computerized system outperform the human when training the dog.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And not just because I think gadgets are fun, but also because I think it's really helpful to get the dog's expectation away from the handler as much as possible, especially when doing detection and tracking. So I think these devices can be really helpful.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I'm really thankful for you coming on here. We had some fun talking about some topics. I know for sure I'm going to have you back on again, and it will be in person, because I'll throw the teaser out now, even though we don't have a date yet. But next year, what we will be doing is having yourself and Florian up to the Michael Ellis School. As we, you and I and Florian and Michael plan this coming up, we will, of course, share it across social media and everything else. But just to get some people kind of excited about it, this is something that will happen in 2024. We will work out the dates. I can't wait. I love being a student around other trainers. I look at it as musicians when we kind of get together. When we get in environments like that, it's awesome to make music. You know, you play your instrument, yes. You know, I'm doing mine, Michael does his floor. And when you kind of get together, even though you don't know each other, you can instantly make music because there's that passion and that commonality between each other as trainers and educators. So I really look forward to that. And I'll tell you more offline at some point, there's even more really cool stuff that's coming up between me, Michael, and some other really well-known trainers, where we want to do exactly that. We want to kind of pull together, randomly pick times, sometimes just to get together ourselves, no other students, just get together as trainers, be around each other, feed off of each other based on some of the different skills that we all have, and do it without any pressure, you know, just having fun to take and learn from each other, and to have sometimes just discussions, just what Michael calls jam sessions, just sit there and have those moments where we question ourselves sometimes, like, you know, I have an episode coming out, right? I just got done editing it yesterday.
Sounds really Michael, nice.
Yes, it'll be fun. Where Michael even questions himself on classical conditioning. He was like, maybe I don't understand it. Maybe I've had it wrong for all these years and stuff like that. So it's pretty funny. But but I think those are the things that help us grow. So, and again, starting like how I started off with you, I've always admired your philosophy and how you're really flexible like that. and that connects with me as another trainer who's going down my own path and journey to become better. So thank you for taking your time to come on here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to meeting you in person.
Same here. And for all those that are watching, I will put the links to your, if you want, I'll put the links to your website and social media in the description. So if they have questions or they want to join and take some of the courses that you offer at SWDI, if you want, real quick, just kind of share what your popular courses are or what you recommend for people if they're interested in learning from you, what they should do.
So they should keep an eye on Facebook. Right now, we are pretty much booked up, and the majority of the courses we do are for units from military or police. So they are not open to the public, unfortunately. But there may be one or two possibilities later this year. But in that case, we will post it on our Facebook page. So I think that is the best spot.
Yes. Okay, perfect. I'll share that. And one of these days, I got to get over to you. You know, of all the traveling I do, I just want to get to your environment and just even hang out and watch and be a fly on the wall with you, because again, that feeds me as well. So hopefully one day we'll be able to make that happen too.
That would be really fun.
Absolutely. Well, again, thank you very much. Again, for all the listeners who listen to this podcast, I thank all of you for tuning in and listening and watching to Canines Talking Sense, where it's okay to be nosy.